Hey everyone, and welcome to the Combat Sports Clinic podcast. This is the place to come if you're looking for conversation around all aspects of combat sports and martial arts, be that competition, training, clinical, coaching, rehab, you name it, we aim to cover it. Okay, in this month's episode, Rosie is talking to Tim Travail. Tim is a sports therapist based in Melbourne, Australia, and his MSc thesis was on the effects of load management on injury risk in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. So this is required listening, whether you're an athlete, a coach, or a clinician. Enjoy the chat, and we'll see you on the other side.
Hi, Tim.
Hey, Rosie.
It's great to have you on the Combat Sports Clinic podcast. For those of our listeners who may not be familiar with you, can you just give us a brief rundown of your background and what is it you do?
So I work in sort of sports injury management, and I've got a bit of an academic background these days. I originally did my undergraduate honours degree in Birmingham in the UK. I think that's where we had a bit of a mutual friend in David Charlton around the jiu-jitsu scene back in 2004, 2005, something like that. I would have seen him sort of sharing a few of your things, and that's
fantastic. Yes, yeah. So
it's a small world that we kind of looping back around and connecting in a bit of a different way 15 years or so later. So I did my undergraduate degree there and was fortunate to sort of get straight into academics, sort of teaching back at one of the universities with some part-time private practice. Initially, I sort of got into rugby as an undergraduate, trying to looking for sports, and really enjoyed that scene. I enjoyed the nature of the injuries that we saw, just the mixture of chronicity and acute management.
It's certainly a challenging sport to be working in from an injury management.
Yes, and I think I pretty much saw it. I'm still probably fairly young in my career, but over 12 years working in rugby, I think I pretty much saw most things there were to see in that sport. So that definitely gave me a kind of a really great grounding in sort of sports injury management. More recently, I wanted to return to some of the studies. I did some postgraduate study in teaching and learning, did a postgraduate diploma there, just looking at sort of the pedagogical and andragogical sort of learnings of teaching. So being involved in teaching, I thought I wanted to get a bit more of a background of that.
Excellent.
And then took me to my MSc, where I looked at the impact of monitoring load for combat sports as an injury prevention tool in combat sports.
So fantastic.
A bit more into that, but that was really an interest area, a little bit clinical from the athletes I was working with. And really my own interest in jiu-jitsu as a combat sport kind of led me down that route.
Fantastic. So I think this is one of the things I particularly wanted to talk to you about today, is that, as I know you wrote your MSc thesis about the effect of load management on injury risk for Brazilian jiu-jitsu specifically. So before we get into the details of that, tell me a little bit about your interest in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and how did you get involved in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu?
I had originally doing some sort of traditional Japanese Jiu-Jitsu for a while, and was interested in the groundwork side of things and the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and mixed martial arts. And once I sort of started adding that into my own training, I couldn't really get enough of it. I'm sure you'll be as aware as anyone of what an addictive sport it is once you get started, and found that I was okay at it and really couldn't get enough. So started training sort of more, picked up my training significantly when I came to Melbourne. So I came over to Melbourne about 7 years ago now. And started training here in Melbourne, and more recently at a gym called Absolute MMA in Melbourne with Lachlan Giles and Craig Jones. Lachlan's got a bit of he did his PhD recently in occlusion training in patellofemoral pain. So it's interesting bouncing some ideas off him, and he's been playing around with a few different styles of training and skill acquisition and things. More recently, he's definitely got one of those minds which he's always looking to try and improve and work on things, reduce injuries and just work a little bit more smarter. And that's very much the principle of workload management, is trying to work smarter. and harder sometimes, but certainly work and train harder. So
absolutely.
That was my clinical, yeah. That was my sporting interest, and it just there was just a big paucity of research in the area. Really, very yes. little out there.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is. Yeah. This is something I've definitely noticed with the combat sports field is that, I mean, until relatively recently, I mean, there's a lot of really old school training methods going on, and because it came from that old martial arts background, and there was a
Absolutely.
Lot of, well, we do it this way because we've always done it that way. And I mean, you see the same thing in with boxing. So certainly sort of until really quite recently, you know, there's a lot of things that are just done because that's the way it's done. And I think with modern sort of mixed martial arts, I think that's actually helped to drag combat sports into the kicking and screaming into the 21st century a little bit. And there's starting to be more sports science involved, which is great. But as you say, there's still a definite lack of research in some of these areas, so it's really good to talk to people like yourself who are out there and doing active research specific to combat sports athletes. And this is one of the reasons I wanted to get you on the podcast to talk about this. I mean, you've got quite a strong background in combat sports yourself. As I said, I mean, there's always a lot of parallels I find when I'm talking between rugby and combat sports as well. There's a lot of crossover with the kind of injuries that we tend to see, I think. Would you agree with that?
I certainly would. I think there's very different training methodologies and methods between the groups. And there's probably different challenges in combat sports. There's probably more similarities than differences with those groups. There's a lot of, I find that sports that are individual in nature have really individual goals to them. And it's difficult from a team perspective to be able to track those goals in the same sort of way.
Yes.
And so, you know, looking at something like a sport of rugby, you've got a coach or someone who might be overseeing what's happening there, because you've got a team, and it's an individual group rather than a group of individuals that you'd see at an MMA gym or a jiu-jitsu gym, who all have slightly different goals that they're working towards. Occasionally, you might, you know, they coincide with the same event or a big thing that there's some tournament that people are working towards, but the vast majority of the time, it's very different.
Everyone's got their own training plan and their own cycle going on.
Absolutely. Everyone's got their own cycle. And I think that's difficult for anyone sort of overseeing it. I mean, it's probably another rarity rather than a norm that we've got sort of performance managers at MMA gyms, with the exception of sort of the higher level. So it's really down to individuals to manage their own load and to look at how they're training. And to really take ownership of that, which I think is difficult. You know, there's quite a big education piece around that hopefully we might be able to help with a little bit today. Some specifics that individual athletes can consider, but it's really about ownership for me of their own training, and people kind of owning what they're doing and not being afraid to sort of speak up when they need to, you know, have a bit of a deload week and that can be particularly challenging in martial arts, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and speaking from my own experience as an MMA fighter, I think that's definitely true. It's one of the most challenging things is getting that is trying to get that balance of training and get the loading right, but at the same time you're trying to fit that in with a schedule that, you know, the gym schedule that has to work for everyone else as well. So on the one hand, it's not all about you, but on the other hand, you know, your schedule doesn't quite match up with anyone else's. And I think that can definitely be challenging for both athletes and coaches trying to make that work. For you might have a number of different fighters who are fighting on different events over the course of, you know, a number of weeks, and trying to get them all peaking at the right point. That can be difficult.
Definitely. And from your experience in MMA gyms, is it something that most athletes would be conscious of? Are they even thinking about their training load other than sort of how do I feel today? Am I ready for a hard session? Do you see much pre-planning? Do you see that sort of improving in the UK?
it's something that people are becoming more aware of. It's still a challenging area because I think almost all MMA fighters overtrain. And a lot of jiu-jitsu athletes as well, but particularly with MMA, because you've got a number of different disciplines going on. You've got so much technical work that you have to fit in. It's very hard to cover all of those different areas. You know, your striking work with your striking coach, you've got your wrestling, you've got, you know, your MMA grappling, you've got the S&C work, and putting all those bits together in a coherent way without overtraining, that's really challenging. So I think that's something that, and it's not helped by the mentality that more is better. You know, I think there's a lot of fighters out there who are still in this very sort of old school idea that go hard or go home. If in doubt, just throw some more in. You know, I'll do a few extra hill sprints because that must be good, right?
And I think what I'd like to probably dive into a little bit, if it's okay with you, is just what the modern research is really saying about workload management, and what do we kind of mean by workload? Because
absolutely,
it might be a little bit of a foreign concept to some people. Some people might have a reasonable grasp of it, but to others, it's probably might not be sure what we're talking about so far. So, maybe even if we just look at sort of some key terms or definition of what we're talking about with load, we're really talking about either a sporting or non-sporting stimulus that's applied to us on our biological system. So that's not just the biological, we're talking about the psychological, and we're talking about sort of social stresses that fit into that. And what we can do using some fairly simple measures in workload is to be able to account for a range of different variables which add stresses to our system. So we're really amazing, complex human beings that adapt to load in an incredible way. But we need to think about the various different types of load which are coming onto us as an athlete, and then how we can manage those.
That's a really interesting thing, because I mean, a lot of fighters, you see, particularly sort of at the lower levels, they'll be working multiple jobs as well as training as a professional fighter. So if you've got somebody who's working 3 or 4 nights a week on the doors, for example, what you're suggesting is that that's actually contributing to workload, and that's something that you have to account for in that overall workload.
Absolutely. And I think that you mentioned like that go hard or go home, more is better. And that touches on sort of the principles of load management around us, an absolute training load. So an absolute training load would be a total amount of load that someone's perhaps doing over a training camp. Now, it's irrespective of the rate or the history of that person's training history, their ability to be able to take on that load. Often people might look at an absolute training load. And I think where the research is going sort of more recently is looking at relative training loads and saying, well, how is light load applied over a period of time? So there's different types of loads that we can look at within that, and we'll explore those further. But I think the relative load is where the traditional, or sorry, the current research is going. So traditionally, if you talk about to an athlete about, how are you managing your load? People are traditionally thinking, oh, they're going to be pulling me back from load. If there's too many injuries, they must be doing too much. And that's actually not necessarily the case. And when I think we can relook at what we've traditionally thought of as overuse injuries to be underprepared injuries. So is it that we're actually doing too much, and that the absolute load is too high? And there is a bit of a ceiling. There seems to be, the research in some sports says the total amount that you're doing, there does seem to be a cap. But more commonly that we see, particularly with MMA athletes, when they're going through training camps and they've got this boom bust mentality of doing lots and dropping down, is how well we're actually preparing and how well we're changing our relative loads.
Right. So what you're saying is that it's not so much a case of too much, but too much too soon in some of these cases.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that too much too soon is really where I think most prominently the research of Tim Gabbett, he's sort of done a lot in various different sports, but just, you know, started off with a lot in rugby league and developed a bit of an injury prediction model around what we call an accrued chronic workload ratio. So And that's having a look at it in its simple form. It's really looking at a training stress balance. So it picked up on the stuff from Bannister in the sort of 70s and 80s, where they looked at a training stress balance and quite sort of commonly talked about in strength and conditioning circles. That was really sort of developed from a performance perspective. And what we've done more recently, and what Gabbett and quite a few other people now have done, is taken that research and said, can we apply it to an injury prediction model? And there's some really quite compelling evidence that is the case.
Yeah.
We can have a look at what an athlete has done in the acute period, which is sort of relatively recently, and comparing that to the chronic period, so a longer period of time, then there's some really good evidence to show that you're setting yourself up for potential injury. Not necessarily immediately, but within a couple of weeks there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in simple terms, what we're saying is that you're looking at how much you're doing this week compared mm-hmm. to how much you're used to doing. So what your body's done over the last month. So your regular training load. And yes, how does what you're doing this week relate? So if somebody has had a month of taking it easy because they're in between fight camps, and they've just taken a fight and they're starting their new fight camp, and they go in and they're suddenly back on two sessions a day,
mm-hmm.
and it's lots more than they have done over the past month, that's when somebody would potentially be at a higher risk of injury. Is that what we're saying?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Spot on. And so the most common way of that people calculate their acute chronic workload ratio is a 7-day average. So let's say you're doing a set amount of load this week, and you're looking at that daily average, an average over the last 7 days, and you're going to compare that to the last 28 days. So you've got a comparison of that 28 to the 7 days. And if you're prepared over that 28 days, and you're training in a consistent fashion, and then we compare that to this week's training load, mm-hmm. let's say you had done, just for argument's sake, 100 units of load per day for the last 28 days. This last week, you would have an acute to chronic workload ratio of 1, because you've been consistent with that load, because the average of the last 7 days is equal to the average of the last 28 days. So that's consistent. Where we start to fall into problems is really when it goes above around 1.3 to 1.5 times your chronic load, or dropping below 0.5.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit variable per sport, but I think as part of my master's research, I did quite a comprehensive literature review of a range of different sports, everything from cricket to tennis to all the team sports where the research is in, and quite consistently we see the same thing across all these different sports.
So it's that same sort of 1.3 to 1.5. So
0.8 to 1.3 is the safe zone.
Right.
Going above 1.3 or 1.5, depending on the sport, is where we really start to ramp up.
Okay. So that's 1.5 times what you're used to doing, basically. So
correct. Yeah.
And that can be either increased volume or increased intensity. Is that?
All right. That's probably where that's a great question, and where we can get into the detail of how you're going to measure load, because it depends.
Excellent.
On how you measure load. So there's thousands of different ways that you could measure load, but the two sort of areas that fits into would either be an external load or an internal load. Now, if we take an external load, measure is any load that's quantified externally to the individual.
Right. So we're looking for an objective.
An objective measure. So mm-hmm. I could say, Rosie, we're going to look at your the time of your session. So you've done a 60-minute session today. Right? I could look at your second session frequency. So you've done, 3 sessions a week, and we're going to have a look at 3 sessions a week. Or we could look at things like your more objective data or more detailed data, like your GPS. So you might get accelerometers and gyroscopes. So accelerometers in many sports that are used would measure obviously the acceleration and deceleration, the sudden stops, the amount of contacts that you might have in rugby.
So if you've got a runner or a cyclist or something like that, that would be quite a logical way to measure things, presumably.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, other external load measures might be like time motion analysis, or even like a specific technique repetition. So that arguably could fit into jiu-jitsu, but it would be too hard work and not without enough rewards.
So I can already see people's eyes glazing over when we start to talk about some of these measurements.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So essentially, fancy bits of equipment that sporting clubs have to try and really accurately measure the amounts of physical activity that people are doing. Yeah. But the positive thing is, certainly for combat sports athletes, is that that's not really any more valid than having a look at what we call session RPE, and including that. Including the amount of time. So session RPE, I'm sure you'll be familiar with, and so just for some of the listeners, is our rate of perceived exertion. So that takes in our perception of effort. How hard do we think a training session is?
So that's so saying to somebody on a scale of 1 to 10, how hard have you worked there?
Absolutely,
Or something like that,
Absolutely, yeah. There's a few different scales out there, but 1 to 10 is the most common, it's the easiest to use, and one I'd advise for everyone. And there is a little bit of a scale out there just to have a look at if people are going to start using it, just because it explains what do we mean by a 7 or what do we mean by an 8. So an 8 is working, you know, extremely hard. So just sort of descriptions of each of those. But so internal load measures, other things could be like a blood lactate measures or heart rate readings, or even the recovery and stress and sort of recovery stress wellness questionnaires.
Okay.
So that's it. So this way of saying
how your body's responding to that stress that you're putting on it. Yeah.
Yes. So we're looking at the specific stress with an external load measure and how are you responding to it? And that's arguably more important. Yeah.
Okay. And would that include, so I know it's become quite trendy recently to look at heart rate variability. So where does that fit into to all of those?
Heart rate variability would be an internal load measure. It's a measure of stress and response to the activity that you're doing. So it would be an internal load measure. But the most validated across all the different research is taking, when we're going to measure someone's load, is your session RPE times by your time. And that will give you your load. So let's say you work 10 out of 10, an absolute max session for 60 minutes, you would have 600 units of load. But if it was a 5 out of 10 on your rating of that session for 60 minutes, then you'd have 300 units of load. And that's the best advice I can give for those two load measures if you're going to start measuring your own load over a period of time. Because it's really easy with a simple training diary, you can measure, you know, you just take down the date, how hard did I work today, how long was that session? And the beauty of that is, You can, as long as you're consistent with it, you can decide what you want to include. So you can include the jiu-jitsu sessions, the MMA, the wrestling, you know, all of the different things, as well as your strength and conditioning. And as long as you're consistent with that and we get those load measures included, then that's how we can start to understand our training stress balance and have a consistent load over a period of time.
So, I mean, that sounds like a really simple thing that people can do for themselves. So, absolutely. I mean, literally at the end of the session, you know, you check your watch, how long have I been training for and how hard did I work? And
Rosie, I'd be happy to share just, I'm monitored, I've got a bit slack with it recently, but when I was training for the Worlds a couple of years ago, I was certainly measuring my loads and I've got a fairly simple Excel spreadsheet that I'd be happy to share with you. And
fantastic. Maybe we'll throw that up on the Facebook group if that's with you.
Absolutely. Yeah, that would be fine. And that's pretty easy to pick up and use yourself and fits a couple of training sessions in a day.
Excellent.
So, yeah.
I mean, that sounds deceptively simple. I mean, that sounds almost too simple in some ways. I think there's people who will look at that and say, that can't possibly be as good as some of these complicated gadgets and bits of kit that I can buy that are going to measure my word. What would you say to that?
Anyone who says that has not actually read the research in detail, I'd say. So there's a beauty in the simplicity of having an internal load measure. Let's say you didn't get much sleep last night and you mentioned about these other stresses that can impact on an athlete's ability to be able to cope with a session. If you don't, you know, a simple, you, if you didn't sleep that well, Your session RPE of this something that let's say you have a wrestling session, the exact same session for you normally might be a 6 out of 10 because you didn't get much sleep last night. That's actually an 8 out of 10 for you. So it picks up these other stresses that are individual to you, and that, you know, it could be a range of different things, but that factors that into the model and means that it actually shows that your overall load is a little bit higher for that week. And so we might need to back off a few other things. And that's what I like about the model, that it has a lot of that applicability. There's not really any one thing that is perfect for everyone, any one measure, but this is as good as any other measure. Now, the people that have got more money, you know, lots of money and can be able to afford to take lots of measures can measure everything. And we can, you know, you can stay on top of that. But it's diminishing returns for the amount of time and effort and money you spent into that. We don't want our athletes to be, you know, sports scientists necessarily, or really get it into the data every day. We want something that's going to be functional. I want something that's going to be functional for athletes to be able to use and actually apply to their training to increase their performance and decrease their chances of injuries.
Excellent. So, I mean, if you're an athlete who's just looking to start doing this, I mean, this is something that you can start doing right away, isn't it? It's if you
absolutely,
you know, yep. You set up a spreadsheet and just track some of these numbers, you can start looking at and you really don't need any additional gear or any, you know, technology or anything like that. You just put the numbers into it.
You just need a little bit of discipline. Yeah? A little bit of discipline to track those each day. But what I used to do is just have a paper diary, and then just at the end of the week, I would kind of fill it out. Now, what I would say is that's looking kind of fairly retrospectively at what you have done.
Yes.
But you know, if you've peaked, for example, you're up at say 1.6 or 1.7 times your ratio of your chronic loads. Yes. You think that you're probably not actually prepared fantastically for the training that you've been doing this week. And that means you're probably getting a little bit of a more of a breakdown of tissues. You might be starting to get a little bit sore. You're those sore muscles and slight damage to either sort of tendons and ligaments and joints, you've got the repair processes going on. And I mentioned earlier on about there's a bit of a delay. It seems to be a bit of a delay anywhere between 1-4 weeks in the injuries after you've spiked your load.
So to be really clear here, we're not just talking about overtraining. So we're not talking about just performance or, you know, the symptoms of overtraining. We're actually talking about concrete injuries. So your overuse injuries, you know, the chances that you're going to get a joint or a tendon or a muscle injury during that training process.
It's an interesting one. There's sometimes some sort of subclinical, injuries, probably sort of underlying things that are being developed there. And it's probably a bit of a gray area between where's my natural healing processes from training and the training adaptations that I'm hoping to get out of all the work that you're doing. And then where are we starting to turn that into a sort of pathology or into an injury? So probably a bit of a bit of a sort of grey area there.
Yeah. So as I say, I mean, we can be talking about anything from, like I say, symptoms of overtraining, so sort of on a systemic level, through to particular, you know. Again, it might be a specific joint or a tendon injury that you pick up. And I mean, the interesting thing about this research is that it seems to suggest that regardless of where that injury comes from, once you hit that that threshold, you know, so once you're going over about 1.5 times the workload you're used to, you're at a higher risk of injuries across the board.
Absolutely. And what I found most interesting about the research when I looked at that is that we're actually talking about both non-contact and contact injuries, which is why I think it does have a ability to martial arts. So looking at the research in rugby, you would think that traditionally we might look at like ACL injuries, or we thought that non-contact injuries were preventable But contact injuries sort of weren't preventable. They're part of the sport relatively. And that sort of thought seems to be a little bit debunked, really, because there's a good link between these training loads and both contact and non-contact injuries.
So, I mean, I'm going to emphasise this because it's quite a surprising finding to some people, is that, I mean, even your just, you had a mad scramble and just randomly blew your ACL out, even that kind of injury is factored in when we're looking at this research. So we're not just talking about those overuse injuries. We're also talking about, you know, the one-offs, you know, that we've traditionally we've just said, oh well, it's just these things just happen.
I didn't tap quick enough, or these things just happen. Yeah. But we are pulling. I'm a little bit cautious of how much, you know, information we pull from other sports. So I don't think I'm saying things out of turn here. So in our world, that would be looking at that external validity of some of the research in other sports. But I think we can compare contact sports pretty comparably. So I think it's very much fair to say that there's very likely to be a reduction in injuries if we and that's both contact and non-contact, if we can manage these in a consistent way. But I don't want any listeners to think we're talking about decreasing the amount of work that people need to do, because there's a very people are doing the physical activity because they want to perform well, you know, people. You very much, there's a very strong correlation between preparing your body with the physical attributes to be able to do that and succeeding in the sport, and also for injury prevention. So you've got to work hard in doing it.
We're not saying that you have to go and wrap yourself in cotton wool or anything like that. You know, that's not the that's not the message here.
Absolutely not. Yeah. And so I think that it's about how do we get to those high training loads to keep them consistent. We've talked about you can often, if an athlete is going to think about how can I apply this to me now, sort of Tim Gabbett and some of the Tim Gabbett particularly talks about this floor and ceiling. And so say right now you can think of your sort of on the floor, that's your current capacity of your current ability to be able to cope with various demands of that sport. And how can we get to from the floor to the ceiling? So how can we get to where we want to be? So let's say we're 12 weeks out and we've got a training camp coming up. Training camp's going to start in 8 weeks. How can we, as safely as possible, get from where we are now to be able to cope with all of those demands of perhaps the peak training period, 10 days out from competition? Or I'm not sure when you started tapering off yourself, Rosie, in competition. When would you say your hardest training weeks were?
I mean, I think a lot will depend on how much weight people are cutting, particularly. So obviously people with a large weight cut, that's going to affect those last few training weeks and how that goes. I mean, I would say it's sort of the 2 weeks out tends to be the hardest sparring sessions. And then you know, from there, there's still quite a lot of technical work and then sort of period tapering, sort of particularly that last week tends to be weight cut week. That's sort of model. I mean, obviously that will vary a little bit by the individual, how much weight they're cutting, you know, and even things like weight class you're in and things like that, I think will affect it.
Absolutely. So let's say we're kind of building up to that period, and what I try and encourage people to do is map out what they expect that training to be. So we've talked about that load, and you might be working with your coaches or planning your own diary, particularly when it comes to a really important event coming up. Where am I at now? And what if I just play around with this data and with these numbers and say that, right, this week I'm going to be doing, two sessions a day. One's going to be hard, one's going to be easy. Let's just map that out and see what that looks like from an acute chronic workload ratio. Does it look like I'm building steadily through these weeks? And do I actually need to start a little bit earlier? Because sometimes I tell people to start backwards. You know, in that, you know, 2 weeks before the competition, you're going to have to be doing three sessions a day. You're going to be going at this intensity. It's going to be hard work. You've got a lot of variability in your training. You've got to be able to cope with all these you know, tough, grueling sessions, put that in and start working tracking backwards from that. If you know you've got to get up to that, when do we need to start that training? So your training camp might start 8 weeks out, but if there's a large gap between where you are now and you know, those maximum demands, those peak demands that you're going to need to get, then you're going to need to start a little bit earlier. Yeah. Otherwise, you're putting yourself at risk. And some people talk about pre-camps or getting ready for training camp, and that's always something that I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the biggest things that comes out when you start thinking about this. Actually, is that sometimes it those weeks or sometimes even months that fighters will take off in between camps, and that can be the thing that really kills your training camp. It's not what goes on in the camp; it's what you didn't do in those few months beforehand. So you start seeing that, you know, having a month off can make a huge difference to where you're starting that training camp from, which then makes a difference to how fast you have to progress it, which can tip you over that threshold, I think. So so that's something that you start looking at more as the big picture of it.
Yeah, and I'd absolutely agree. I think we need to start seeing training loads and higher training loads as a vaccine against injury, and higher consistent training loads. So I mentioned earlier on, I think about this sort of sweet spot of sort of 0.8 to 1.3, but we also know that it's actually there was an interesting research, and I don't want to get to bore people with the research too much, but it was called the injury prevention, so the workload injury prevention paradox. So we thinking that when we actually look at total amounts of load that people are doing, it's actually higher training loads are protective against injury. So keeping that load high means that you're better prepared to be able to cope with those demands that, you know, you can't control a lot of those demands. You've got your opponent, you've got their qualities, you've got their strengths. So if you're better prepared from a physiological point of view, you know, you've got those strengths, you've got those biometric, those qualities that it means that you've got good mobility, you've got good strength, which across a range of sports have been shown to them in themselves mitigate against, you know, some injuries. If you're training hard and often, then that's a good thing. That's what we want to see. That is protective, but just get there in a safe way.
Right. So, I mean, what we're looking at here is it's not so much the high loads that's the problem, it's the inconsistency.
Absolutely, yeah. And one other sort of there's a blog out there on drinking beer. I'm not sure if you've seen it for work as a comparative to workloads. That it was another one of Tim Gabbett's work.
Okay, I've not seen this.
Okay, so I'm sure this won't apply to many of the listeners here. But let's say, do you remember back at perhaps when you went to university and you went from probably maybe not drinking so much in the run up to that, and you go and have your first couple of beers, and it's really painful that next day. You perhaps you can have one or two beers, you get pissed really quickly, and you know you the next day you have that, you have a hangover, you've got muscle aches, you're not quite sure what happened. But this, once you start bringing some consistency into having a couple more beers, you realize that actually you don't get so many of the negative consequences to that, to the stimulus, to the alcohol. And and the more you do that, you can slowly build up your tolerance to that alcohol. And then you know, you're doing 10 or 12 beers and you're feeling right as rain the next day and can go and train.
We're not endorsing this. Just to be clear.
Absolutely not endorsing this. This is just purely an anecdote to see if we can just understand principles of maintaining sort of loads, and how if we do something that we're not accustomed to with a sudden increase in that, then it's that has negative consequences for us, and you certainly feel it over the next sort of days.
Excellent. So, I mean, I think one of the big challenges that both athletes and coaches find with some of these ideas, when I've spoken to fighters about it, the one thing they'll usually say to me is that it's really hard to go in and say to a coach and say to yourself and your training partners, right, I'm going to have an easy session today. Mm-hmm. I think I'm not going to go 100%. because that seems to be quite counterintuitive or counter to the prevailing culture. And I think it's very hard for coaches as well sometimes to pull their fighters back and say, you know what, I want you to go less than your maximum. I don't want you to try as hard as you possibly can. That seems to be quite a new idea. I mean, do you have any thoughts around that or any tips for how people can kind of manage those loads?
Absolutely. And I think that's conversations. Obviously, it always helps when you've got a good kind of respectful relationship and you've got mutual respect between athletes and their coaches in those situations. Mm-hmm. But what I actually sell often, and I said that I haven't, performance isn't my background, injury prevention is more of my background, but when I talk to coaches about injury load, I talk to it on the basis of applicability to performance enhancement as opposed to injury prevention. And coaches can often get buy-in to do these activities sometimes quicker than sort of individuals themselves. And I think we've seen that in a lot of other sports. When we have a look at injury prevention programs like FIFA 11 Plus or the Nordic Hamstring Curls or ACL programs, all great programs, great research to say how they're going to stop you getting all of these nasty injuries. But no one does them. And if no one does them, then they've got very little impact on injuries. Yeah. But if we can get, and what I've done more recently is sell those as this is a performance enhancement program, not an injury prevention program. Yeah. And that's why they're following it. And that really supports buy-in. And there's some truth to that. In reality, it isn't quite as strong for in terms of performance compared to injury prevention, because there's so many other variables for performance enhancement. You have, you know, the quality of the opposition, and there's external variables, which impact on whether you necessarily win or lose. And so it's a little bit easier for us to gather information on whether someone's going to prevent injuries or not. So that's why I just think that research is strong, but there's also lots to say that, you know, lots of research to say the more hours that you spend training and not injured, the better your team performs.
Yes.
And that's a lot of thoughts. And there's absolutely, that's got to be applicable to jiu-jitsu. If you ask a coach, Do you think that hours on the mat is important? Absolutely. I can't imagine anyone wouldn't agree to that. They want to see those hours. And if you can help them understand that the quality of those hours, and you're going to get an increased total amount of hours without necessarily pushing to that max efforts every time, then you're going to get more output.
Absolutely.
You're going to get more time on the mat with this athlete.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I've definitely found when talking to people. When you talk about injury prevention, people often sort of tune out or switch off, particularly the youngsters who haven't been injured yet. Because when you're 19, you're immortal. You know, you can do anything. This isn't going to happen to you until it does. And at that point, it's too late. But I think that's one of the difficulties when you're talking about injury prevention. The point I'll always make is exactly the same thing you've said, is that if you're training, you're on the mat consistently and you're not injured, you're going to get much better than somebody who's off the mat every other week because they've pulled something or, you know, they're straining something. So that consistency of training is really, really important. And I think trying to get that across to people and trying to get people to take that long-term view of development, I think that's going to be, so with this next generation coming through, I think we're going to see the difference between the people who do that and the people who've got coaches who are thinking on that level and the fighters who don't. I think that's really going to become more and more evident.
I think I'd very much agree with that. And I think that we're just becoming, every part of society is becoming a little bit more data driven in what we do. So I'm wearing an Apple Watch right now. Many people are. They're just sort of getting used to collecting data, not necessarily being that sure what to do with it right now. But that's getting better.
Yeah.
And I think that will be really sort of applicable, as you say, to people who are more used to collecting data. So they're happy to do that for themselves once they sort of understand and they're educated on the benefits that it can have for their own performance.
And I think understanding which bits of data are important and what you can ignore as well, because again, it's easy to get swamped by these things when, you know, there's so much out there. And I think having a few simple things, like we talked about earlier with the duration times intensity, duration times perceived exertion, I think having those really simple ways of dealing with it, that makes a lot of sense to me. I mean,
and I was just going to sort of mention that I think that there's not that much data we need to gather, and that the worst thing you can do is gather every bit of data under the sun and then not really be sure what to do with it, because it's just it's a waste of your time and it's a waste of everyone's time. So work out sort of what you want to do with that data and then sort of collect it. But we can keep things really that simple. The only other thing I'd add to that is a bit of a wellness score. I think we mentioned it on about these other stresses that can fit into that can impact on your ability to be able to cope with those sessions. So there's a real simple, like a how well do you feel today when you wake up, and just a 1 to 5 score, and that's actually been shown in the research to be also predictive of injury. So if you get 3 days in a row where you're 2 scores below your average wellness, then either between 1 and 2 below your average on that 5-point scale, then that's also been shown to correlate with an injury. So listen to your body. And I think it's a good way of doing that is just tracking it over a few days in a row. So simple well-being score, wellness score, how are you feeling today? And just listen to yourself if it drops sort of a few days in a row below the average for you.
Yeah, because again, I mean, this is something that I see really often, especially when you've got fighters who are training hard, they're cutting weight at the same time. A lot of the time, you know, you'll get to that point mid-camp when people will be feeling quite under the weather. And the question they'll often ask is, well, should I push through this, or should I listen to my body and take a few days off here? So again, what you're saying is that if you've tracked that over a period of time, that gives you something a little bit more concrete that you can look at and go, you know what, I really should take a day off here.
And going into the higher levels, there's definitely more sort of complex things that you can do there in terms of well-being scores, and there's sort of athlete readiness questionnaires and sort of more detailed things you can go into, which I would recommend if you're working at a higher level and you're working, if you're a coach and you're working sort of with athletes, then it's a good idea to sort of check in a few times during that training camp. But I'm sure if coaches have got a good relationship with that athlete, they can probably tell just as well as a questionnaire in a lot of those ways, as to, you know, how they're feeling. But and don't be afraid to sort of trust that intuition and back off a little bit of training loads, or work out, you know, when you can increase those training loads just as much.
So sometimes it makes sense to do less rather than more. I think I mean, one of the analogies that I like that I've seen used a bit recently is that of training being like it's like a medication. You know, if you give somebody a drug, there's an optimal dose, and you know that's the right amount for that person at that time. And if you're going over that, that can be as bad as, you know, going under it. So if your training plan is exactly the optimal amount of training that you should be doing, that's going to get you to where you want to be. If you then go and do your extra set of hill sprints because you think you should, that's actually going to make you worse rather than better, because it's going to take you over that optimal load.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I think I agree with that. And I think that if you're at the level where you're working with a coach and they've probably put a lot of thought into your training plan, there's a reason that they want you to be at 100% when you hit that next training session. And there's a day of rest in there for a purpose. The day of rest isn't in there for you to necessarily decide your own type of training that you want to do that day.
Yes.
active rest.
Yeah. This is something I was talking about with Chris Muir, who's one of the S&C coaches who I work with quite closely with some of the fighters that I see. And we were talking about this in our first podcast when we were saying about mistakes fighters make and silly things that fighters tend to do. And one of the most common is when a fighter, you've got the training plan and then they suddenly just decide they're going to go out for an extra 10-mile run just because.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, from the point of view of being a fighter, you know, from our point of view is looking at injury management and training management, load management, that looks ridiculous. But from the point of view of a fighter, that can make complete sense. Because I think that, that mentality that you're in, you know, constantly, I've got to outwork the other guy, I think is so prevalent. And one of the things, I've been really pushing is to try and get people to shift from I've got to outwork the other guy to I've got to outthink the other guy. That comes in when you're planning as much as when you're actually in there.
There's a sort of meme culture around that, isn't there? It's, you know, I can't sleep while the other guy might be working. And,
there's an
emotional component to that that gets fighters doing stuff that's perhaps not necessarily as smart as it could be.
I'm the best because I've worked the hardest. And I think it's getting through to people. You're at a level now where everyone's working hard. You can't just keep working harder than the other guy because there's only so much your body can do. There's only so many hours in the day. You know, at some point, there's a line there where you can't just keep, you know, throwing more stuff at it. You can't throw more training at it. You've got to be smarter with the training that you've got. And I think that's, you know, the sport has long since reached that point. So that's where.
Okay. The thing I thought might be worth just sort of us exploring a little bit more was the using these same principles for people when they do sort of sustain injuries, either inside camp or outside of camp.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And thinking about these principles of maintaining a consistent load, even when you're injured. So I think that it's easy to get relatively sort of deconditioned globally as a body. So let's say we sprain an ankle, you know, you're wrestling, you sprain an ankle. It's easy for the rest of our body to get fairly deconditioned while we're really focusing on getting that ankle strength. So you go to your physio and we're going to build up this strength. We're going to work on this proprioception. We're going to build up your confidence to really be able to get that ankle strong. And sometimes just a bit of that, what's your whole body doing? Are you going to be ready when your ankle's ready? Is the rest of your body going to be ready? And so I just encourage people to have a look at all the different ways that they can be training around that injury. We've really got to respect the tissue biology and tissue healing times, and I've got no sort of problems with that at all. But I think we can still we can modify and work with sort of taping and bracing at times to help with something like an ankle injury or a knee injury, to be able to do a little bit more activity than we'd otherwise manage. But have a think about that sort of other cross training and really sort of keep those loads up. So then when you're out of rehab and you're back into that group, then your chronic load is relatively high. So when you're comparing that to your acute load when you're back in training, we avoid that spike again. And that spike is those sort of slightly dangerous times from an injury perspective.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. And from my experience, I think that's a more technical explanation of something that I'll talk to my fighters about all the time. When I say I'd always much rather keep somebody training as much as possible around the injury rather than stopping them altogether. Because if you stop somebody training altogether, the first thing that happens when you take the reins off and you say, right, you can go back to training, is they'll go mad and they'll massively overdo it. And then they'll be back in the next week, if not with the original injury, with something else. And this is a pattern that I see so often with people. It's like I say, it's one of the most, I mean, I joke about it. I say with the fighters, you fix one thing and they'll go off and break something else. So I'm always telling people, no, I want to keep you training. We need to be sensible about what you're doing, but we need to keep you doing something. So and working around that, and so gradually building up that stress on that injured area. You know, we're not going to wait till that's completely better and then throw you right back in where you were before. We've got to progress it gradually. So I think that's that really fits with my experience.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Because it can definitely be a pretty lonely place for athletes in that sort of team rehab for a little while. So the quicker that we can get them back into training, and I think, so you get someone with that ankle injury, again, to use that example, if they've got a fairly significant injury and other people see them back on the mats within a couple of weeks, they're more likely to respect that person's injury and to help work around and not go 100% with them. Whereas if they don't see them for 6 weeks and then they see them back in on the mat, they're likely to think, well, they've taken all that time, they must be 100%, they're ready to go.
Yeah, and I mean, that's one of the biggest risks of re-injury, I think, is when people take those longer stretches of time off. Actually, if we can keep somebody training, I think they're at a lower risk of re-injury. As you say, people sort of gradually build up the stress on the injured area. They get used to training and they get used to progressing that, rather than them thinking that, right, everything's fine now, I can just pick up where I left off. And I think that's a real issue. So absolutely.
I think there's some really nice links from sort of things like the hamstring research out there, which says that exposure to high speed sprinting is it's a risk factor for hamstring injuries, but it's also the thing that protects against future hamstring injuries. So even if you've got something that is a bit of a weak point, we've got to be exposing people to high level training in those things that we're perhaps a little bit worried about. Yeah. Yes, we're going to get there safely, but we need to make sure that you're exposed to that in a controlled way in the gym before you're going to go into your, you know, into your training. How many times do you see MMA fights where, you know, they've coming back from a knee injury and they redo that knee injury? They've gone through a full training camp, but they re-injure that, you know, within the first 30 seconds of a fight, because they likely haven't exposed themselves to quite enough of those pressures. Probably haven't had a long enough, you know, layoff, but that's the nature of it. So I think, again, just encouraging getting back up to those high levels of training loads is really important before you're going to be testing yourself in competition.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm nodding frantically here because this brings us into sort of the one of the big things that I'm always banging on about, which is that sport specific rehab as well, and how that progressive loading is so important to getting people back to where they were before. And this is something I've looked at, particularly with a lot of the neck injury stuff that I've been doing recently, is about how you get people to condition and strengthen all of those muscles and tissues around the neck so that they can tolerate the level of force that you're going to put on them in those, you know, combat situations. And I think that's true whether you've got somebody who's had an injury or not. That same process of building up that tolerance for those forces, that applies just the same. Need to progress things gradually rather than just throwing people in at the deep end and hoping that everything's going to be okay. So I think this is one of the big things, I think, when it comes to sport-specific rehab in any sport. I think one of the things that combat sports athletes can struggle with sometimes is that they don't have, you know, a team therapist or a team physio who's really familiar with what they need to be able to do. And again, this is one of the reasons I set up Combat Sports Clinic, is to try and build that network of people who understand a bit about the sport, who understand the mechanics involved and what, you know, the stresses involved, who can give people good advice specific to what they need.
I think I'm fortunate at the clinic that, not the clinic, at the gym I'm at. So I mentioned Lachlan Giles. His wife, Olivia, is also a physio. So they're both physios. That's that understand the sport very well and coach parts on physio. So it's sort of a gym they're fairly well catered for. But there's a lot of places that, as you say, I think particularly with these types of combat sports, with any sport, it's important to understand the requirements. But it's relatively easy for someone who doesn't play tennis to understand the requirements of tennis. I think it's very difficult for someone who hasn't had martial arts experience to understand the types of loads and stresses that someone is going to go through as they're returning to, you know, into combat sport. It's just a little bit different.
I think that's and that's probably a nice place to start wrapping up. So Thank you very much for your time with all of that. Is there anything else you'd like to add, just in closing?
Look, I think that's probably the only last bit I was thinking about adding was that this is really just adding specificity to what you might have seen clinically or heard around something like the 10% rule. So you'd see a runner in clinic and we're talking about adding 10%, you know, per week. These are nice, simple, relatively safe guidelines to mean that we are progressively building our load up to high levels. There are issues around that 10% rule that it's very different for someone who's a low level runner, perhaps running 5Ks a week. That's massively different to someone who's at the top end, who's running 160Ks, and then you end up sort of adding a huge amount of load on the end there. So I'd encourage people to embrace tracking their own load and using this, these simple measures. So looking at that rate of perceived exertion times by your time and tracking that for your injury prevention and for your performance goals. And if you can try and maintain that within sort of between 0.8 to 1.3, that's generally going to be pretty good. Keep tracking your wellness, just listen to your body around that, and that all of this stuff is really going to help you build resilience and robust and be a strong, robust athlete, and you're going to be able to cope with those demands and ultimately perform better, and that's kind of what we're all here for. So
fantastic. This is really important stuff, I think, for people, because I mean it's not sexy, it's not in the way that, you know, people have sort of new techniques and new training methods and things, and it's all very exciting and shiny and people like it. This stuff, it's really the the accounting end of
I'm guaranteeing that sort of, you know, a significant proportion will say, I'm not going to worry about tracking my load, but I'm going to go and make sure I get my cryotherapy and my my oxygen chamber and my going to get my foam rolling done and going to do this and that. Whereas load management is the core of what we should be doing from performance and injury prevention perspective. Everything else is the 1 to 5 percenters. So that's actually originally why I got it. Interested in this research. I was a bit bored by the circular arguments of what was a better way to massage this hamstring or needle this muscle, and I got bored with those, and I thought that there's got to be there's more interest for me in working out how we can get these principles of core load working for our athletes better in combat sports. And that's really what drove me to my master's and has kind of taken me onto my sort of PhD work that I've just taken on sort of over the last few months.
Fantastic. Well, it's been great to talk to you, Tim. I really appreciate your time with all this. If people want to get in touch with you, is there a way they can do that?
Yes, very happy to discuss this with anyone, really. So I'm just on my surname, so at Travail on Twitter. That's probably a good way to get a hold of me. I'm working out of Complete Sports Care in Melbourne. That's just in Hawthorne in Melbourne. And other than that, I'm happy just to I'll send you my email and people can make that available with the Excel file if we want to sort of use that.
We'll try and throw some of these links up on our Facebook group so that people can access those.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on, Rosie. Great to talk and to connect with you.
Thanks again for your time, and it's been great to have that conversation, and hopefully we'll be able to get together and do some more together in the future.
I look forward to it. That'll be good.
Brilliant.
So there you have it. Hopefully you found that as interesting to listen to as we did to produce. As ever, if you've got any suggestions, comments or feedback on what we can do differently or better, do please let us know. You can comment on our SoundCloud page, our Facebook, Instagram and Twitter feeds. Just search for Combat Sports Clinic, or you can create a profile at our website at www.combatsportsclinic.net and join in the discussion there. Now, speaking of the website, if you're a martial artist or combat sports athlete, you should check out our free video library. We're updating this all the time with new content about what to do to keep yourself fighting fit, as well as advice on managing those trivial and not so trivial injuries that we all pick up from time to time. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on the next podcast.